Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics from year 8 up to year 13.
And physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time A-level mostly physics teacher, year 7 space. I set them work and I said, to start off with, just three questions you want to ask about space. And the questions that have come in from the few kids that have done it, and not many in my class are doing it in year 7, they're just brilliant. Just brilliant. Mm. Is it true gravity can bend light?
Oh, great question.
What a great question. What's a black hole? All that sort of stuff. Brilliant. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah, I remember one year 7 once asking me, saying, okay, so if the universe is getting bigger all the time, like you say, how come we're not getting further away from each other?
Mm.
What a great question.
That is a great question.
And it's just they ask those great questions when they're in year 7. I don't think there's any side to them at that stage. And they sort of, you know, so it's great. They haven't got that ennui that they seem to build up in year 8
of
it.
Just want to ask. I have a question that I had to ask a real physicist, like a professor. And it was, if the speed of light is a speed limit and the universe is very large and it's getting bigger all the time, surely the things on the other side of the universe are going away from us at faster than the speed of light. How is that possible?
Uh-huh.
And he said that's allowed because it's a slow expansion on a big scale, which I thought was fair enough. Anyway, I digress. Now, lurking in the background, we have a guest this week.
Yes. Hello, Lurker.
Hello, Lurker. It's a friend of the podcast who has bought us a coffee, Robin. He's bought us a coffee, which we are saving up till we can actually be face-to-face and spend it on booze. So welcome back to the podcast, friend of the podcast, Dr. Dave Farmer.
Hello. Is this your new thing now? If you want to come on the podcast, we've got to buy you a coffee. Is that...
Hey, if you buy us a coffee, you can come on as many times as you want, mate. I'll tell you that's...
You really can. Why is Dave on the podcast? He very kindly tweeted out after the last podcast or a couple of podcasts ago that he'd made a resource for teaching specific heat capacity. And I got in a dialogue with him and we ended up talking about the uncertainty and how we talk about uncertainty. And he said, have you done an episode on that? And I said, no. So here we are. Dr. Dave. We'll have to call you Dr. Dave, won't we? Dr. Dave and Robin and I are just going to talk about uncertainties. And just my question is, it's a very uncertain thing, isn't it? One of the things I say to the kids is the only certain thing about uncertainties is how uncertain they are. But there's no sort of agreed way we all do uncertainties, even for something like a line of best fit and error bars.
Mm.
So I just wanted to talk through your take on it. And I know you've got a special insight into this, Dave. You were telling us offline that you've been teaching 4 years and you've taught 3 different boards at A-level.
Yes. Yeah. And they're all mostly similar, but then there's slight subtleties and you've really got to dig into it. Like, you know, do they want plus or minus a whole graduation on a measurement, or do they want just half a measurement?
Well, that's a really good starting point, isn't it? Because I was driven nuts by a question the other day. So they had, it's quite an old question on AQA, which is what I teach, and they had a graph, and the point on the graph they wanted the kids to identify was exactly between two solid lines on the scale. Let's say the two solid lines are 3.3 and 3.4. Now, I had taught them that if it's, you have to make a judgment call, and if it's bang in the middle, you round up. So I would have said it was 3.4. Mark scheme, 3.35. What's your take on that?
I would tend, I can sort of see arguments all ways. What I tend to do is look at the mark schemes and just try adjust based on that. It seems to be one of these things. It's a little hard to get really, really clear information on. I've just spotted another thing. I've got the two textbooks open. I've got AQA and OCR's textbooks open in front of me now, and both of them actually quote the errors. In AQA, I think they'd say you only ever quote your error to one significant figure. And then in the OCR's textbook, I've got a 3.75 plus or minus 0.17 ohms. So that clearly doesn't hold there as well. And it just seems to be the way it is with uncertainties. It was always my experience at university and when I was a researcher as well, is while there are incorrect ways to do it and methods of doing it, there isn't really a convention across all of science where this is the way that you should analyze your errors. This is the way you should state your uncertainties.
So let me put you both on the spot. So Robin, you are there. What would you have taught for a point exactly halfway between 3.3 and 3.4? What would you have told the kids to say that was?
If it was exactly halfway and it was clearly obviously halfway, yeah, I would have said it was 3.35 plus or minus 0.05, I think I would say. Would I? No, 0.025. Is that right? Basically, if you can see, if you can make out the difference between the two lines, and you can definitely say that in the middle is different from being on the line, if the scale resolution is that great, then yeah, I'd say you go for halfway between the two, and then of course you could be a quarter of a square either way, if you see what I mean, because then you're looking at resolution of the ruler, right? Resolution of the scale.
Okay, that makes perfect sense to me. What about you, Dr. Dave?
I think I'd have probably said 0.35 plus or minus 0.05. I would think you'd probably only want your error to one significant figure.
See, I thought about it after reading the Mark scheme, and I was taught, back in the day, 1862, that the scale is only as good as the numbers on it. So if you've got 3.3 and 3.4, you can't judge between the two. You have to choose one of them and you round up. So that makes it 3.4. So I would say 3.4 plus or minus 0.1. But having thought about it, and the AQA talks about readings and measurements, and a reading is something that you only judge the top end, so that zero is set like a measuring cylinder, and a measurement is where you judge the start and the end of the measurement, like the width of a table. And so you can take that point on the graph as if it's a reading plus or minus half a division, and if you genuinely cannot judge whether it's between the two, it's fair to take halfway plus or minus half a division, which I think is what you said, Dr. Dave, and Robin, you kind of talked around that. You would have given less uncertainty, I think.
Yeah, so that's the thing. So I think if you're genuinely saying that you can read halfway between the two points, then I'd say you're uncertain. And I take the point about the number of significant figures. So you might round up your plus or minus 0.025 to 0.03, but fundamentally your range of uncertainty is you're saying I can measure to the nearest half of a gradation, so therefore my uncertainty is a half of the band either way, if you take my meaning. So the total uncertainty range is 0.05, and you're taking half of that.
Yeah, I do see that, actually. But I can understand your argument. Like, I could be convinced of that argument, but then...
I can see that argument too, and this is the problem, isn't it?
I would love
to see what people think of this if they tweet us at PhysicsDP. With what would you give the uncertainty and the value for a reading exactly halfway between 3.3 and 3.4. I would love to see what people come up with that.
I think if a student was listening to this, they'd throw their hands up in the air and say, well, what chance do I stand then? And I do really sympathise with them for this. And I sympathise also because, the exam boards, and you won't get me sympathising with the exam boards very often, but I sympathise with them too, because there is no, and as Dave said, there's no hard and fast rule on this, and that makes it really, really difficult for everybody to try, because everybody's trying to interpret it in their own way, so it could do with a little bit more clarity, I think. Yes, and I think we've all found our ways of kind of fiddling through this over time, haven't we? And it would be really interesting to hear what other people have to say.
I would say, and I think that there's good logic for, if we're saying, if it was on 3.4, you would say it was 3.4 plus or minus half a division. No doubt there. Why would it become less of plus or minus if you were reading halfway between the divisions? So I think 3.35 plus or minus 0.05 is fine. I actually don't like your going making the uncertainty even less. I don't like that.
I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking in your example, Robin, an uncertainty of plus or minus 0.25 or 0.3, however you decide to quote it, depending on which exam board you currently are suffering under. That would imply that you could distinguish a difference of 0.3. Now, whether or not that's true, would you say that your eyesight's good enough to tell between, say, 3.33 and 3.36?
So I think what it is if...
Which is what your version, I think, would imply, then.
So what I'm saying is if it's anywhere in between the kind of 0.5 from 0.25 up to 0.75, if you get me, you call it... 0.5, you call it half, and if it was outside of those, it'd either be the gradation below or the gradation above. So that's my thing. So if you imagine, if you were looking at your scale, Thomas, and if you drew in a smaller line for halfway that was on your scale,
don't go down that rabbit hole, okay, because then there's uncertainty on where I draw the line.
No, no, but I mean, if the exam board had presented it with a small line halfway between the two points.
But the point is they hadn't. If they put another line in, this goes back to my argument of how I was taught, doesn't it? That if they've got lines there, that's what the only certainty you have. So there is an argument that you should say it's 3.4. Mm. But I accept that you can take 3.35, but I don't accept you could, just because it's in the middle, that your uncertainty is less. I think your uncertainty is still half a division.
Okay. No, that's fine. I mean, yeah, it is interpretation, because I'm thinking now about a ruler with just centimetres marked on it.
So I'm thinking back to, it's a slightly different measurement, but it was quite a long argument I had in a research paper where we were presenting some data, which essentially was some frequency analysis of some sort of vibrational signals we had. So there were peaks on these spectrum, and we would obviously, the location of the peak was important, as the sort of the peak frequency was the natural frequency of the polymer film we were measuring. And I had gotten a rather large argument with our researchers, myself and my supervisor, about how accurately we could determine the peak, because the peak obviously fell slightly in between two points on our sort of spectrum. If you imagine that the spectrum had a certain resolution, and the peak clearly fell some point in between those two. And so we were saying, well, okay, well, you would take the average of those two, you go in between, and then your uncertainty is exactly as Thomas and I have just said, where, let's say you had a point on 2 hertz and a point on 2.1 hertz, then we'd said, right, well, the peak will take the average in there. Now they were arguing, my co-workers were arguing that actually you could fit a peak and then you'd get a much higher, and they were ready to claim some really, really small uncertainty. Because they were just relying on the fitting to do that. But myself and my supervisor were saying, well, no, the only two data points we have are here and here. Yes, we can probably say we think it's more likely to be, closer to this one than this one. But if those are the two data points, we have to accept that the uncertainty is that we know the peak is somewhere between those two, but we don't know quite where. So our uncertainties, our stated error on it, had to include that range. And yeah, it was a long argument and delayed the paper by 6 months. Knocked it down a couple of times. Myself and my supervisor won. Probably more tenacity rather than whether or not we were actually right about uncertainties, I don't know. But so I think, yeah, I'm now leaning back more towards Thomas. I don't think you can convince me this 0.25 thing anymore. You've lost me.
Mm-hmm. I think we need to write a book, The Physics Teaching Podcast Guide to Uncertainty, and our riches will be assured.
Absolutely.
We will nail it down.
It'll be a million seller.
Yeah, millions.
We'll do that, and then the exam boards will change the spec.
Yeah, but based on our book. Yeah. Based on our book. So look, that we've been talking nearly 15 minutes about really what is the value between 3.3 and 3.4 exactly between. It is such a minefield. Let's move on to a line of best fit. Now, assume the scenario, I have done an experiment, I have some error bars, I'm not even going to go down the worm of how we do our error bars here, and I've drawn a line of best fit, and I want my kids to do uncertainty using a second line. Now, I used to call that the line of worst fit. I no longer do, thanks to you, Robin. I think it's, can you give me the argument you gave me that day that changed how I talk about that, please?
Yeah, so I used to say best and worst lines of best fit. So I'd say you take your best and your worst lines of best fit, and you take and those give you the limits of your uncertainty. And then I think it was because a student asked me a question, said why is the best one better and the worst one worse? And of course there is no best and worst line, it's just steepest and shallowest. So I moved to steepest and shallowest lines of best fit, because I thought, even though it's more of a mouthful, it might be slightly less accessible to them immediately. I thought it was actually better in the sense of actually describing what's going on. Best and worst sort of seemed to me to imply that one was better than the other. Steepest and shallowest was actually what I was after. I was saying the steepest line that can possibly go through all of your points and the shallowest line that can possibly go through all of your points, those are the limits of your uncertainty. Those are your confidence limits, if you like, and your real value, if you like, your value that you're going to quote as being halfway in between that range is just the midpoint.
So it's not even, you don't even use worst line of best fit, which is what I use now, because when we spoke about this, I was using draw your line of worst fit. not your worst line, a best bit. Because you see the difference. Can you see the difference there?
Not quite
sure. Line of worst fit. Line of worst fit. Definitely no. Now, worst line of best fit. You would still say no. It's still. I would say it's the worst line of best fit. So you've got the line of best fit, and then you've got the worst line of best fit. The one that's the furthest away, but still in your error bars. That's your worst line of best fit. And then your uncertainty is the difference in gradient between the line of worst fit, the worst line of best fit, and the best line of best fit.
So I think because it's because the way I teach it now is I don't get them to do the middle line anymore at all, because it's a waste of time. If you've done the two extremes of your range, your midpoint is just a notional midpoint that you quote for convenience. You know, basically, what are we saying with uncertainties? We're saying that the value is between these two values. We're not saying it is this value plus or minus something. We're giving a range of values in which we're confident the value sits, if you see what I mean. So that's what uncertainties are. So I just say, well, basically, what we're trying is our two limits of uncertainty. And then when we quote it, the convention is to have the one that's halfway along plus or minus half the range. That's the convention we quote it to.
So are you saying they would draw the steepest and shallowest, and then their actual value, because they'd have to give a value in an exam, is the mean of those two
gradients? So let's say steepest gradient is 3, shallowest gradient is 2. They draw those two lines, they work out the gradients for both of them, they get 3 and 2, and then their overall quote is 2.5 plus or minus 0.5.
Okay. How do you teach it, Dave?
So I get them to do a line of best fit. And then I get them to do what I was calling a line of worst fit. Although then I had a discussion with you. I think worst line of best fit is still a mouthful. I mean, the key word is fit. You've just got to emphasize that the line still has to fit.
Yes.
That is important. So I'm thinking I might go to worst line that fits to really emphasize that it still has to fit, but it can be the worst possible version of that. Or the shallowest line that fits, or the steepest line that fits. Something like that might be what I will now start using. But I would use a line of best fit. I would draw one steepest or shallowest line of worst fit. It doesn't really matter, which would be the line that sort of hits within the error bars. And then the difference between those gradients gives you your plus minus uncertainty. You could draw a third line in there if you really needed to, and then do half the range between your steepest and shallowest. But that, I think, is overkill.
I agree. And certainly AQA don't steer you towards that in their practical handbook. They steer you towards the line of best fit, and then the steepest or shallowest line that fits, and then the gap between them is the uncertainty.
Yeah, and that's how in OCR as well, that is sort of explicitly how it's shown in sort of the OCR textbook, that's the way to do it. I sort of understand your way of doing it, Robin, but it doesn't, I would still think that, you know, you should be, when you're curve fitting, you should still be trying to fit the best curve and trying to take your value from that. And then, because the thing is, it's kind of the key thing, and why it's such a probably a hard thing is, all we're doing is we're estimating our uncertainty. You know, it's because it is not a precise measurement. You know, a precise measurement of uncertainty. If you see what I mean, it is an estimate. And that's probably, to be honest, that's what I would like the exam boards to be able to do, is to say, look, there are a few different methods you could use, as long as the students have made a reasonable estimate of the uncertainties using some sort of recognised method, then I'd be happy with that. But that's far too vague for a mark scheme, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I think they do support that from what I remember. I haven't done marking. I may be completely wrong, but certainly on mark schemes, I think I've seen that a fair attempt has been made in the judgment of the marker. It's interesting that I think we did all sort of agree there now on how to talk about it. I was wondering about, are there some things we can all agree on quickly I'm interested just to see. Let me ask you some questions. So you take it in turns to answer them. Robin first. So you've done an experiment. You've got a value of 6.3 plus or minus 10%, which gives you 6.3 plus or minus 0.63. You would round that up to 6.3 plus or minus 0.7, Robin?
No, because it's 0.63. I'd round it down to 0.6.
Dave?
That I would quote as 6.3 plus or minus 0.6, yeah.
See, I would round it up because it's uncertain and you should always be pessimistic. So it's interesting, this. We don't agree.
Well, no, but this is the thing. I think this is one of the things that I do discuss with kids, is that basically I tell them that there are people, and I think, Dave, you know, your anecdote earlier on from your days as a research scientist is really interesting, because it's about, you know, there are people who make whole careers out of this, and there are experiments that are so dependent, and obviously the Higgs boson is the one that springs to mind, but they're so dependent on getting the treatment of uncertainties right that there's whole statistical fields of discipline that revolve around doing this properly. We don't do that in an A-level lab because we could spend the rest of our careers doing it, and that's kind of not why we're here. So we're going with a kind of a set of tools that allow us to take shortcuts, and it's not precise. And, you know, if you came into physics hoping for precision, it's going to be a bit disappointing to you. But nonetheless, there is a clear onus on you to, first of all, be able to do it, and secondly, to be able to justify it. And providing that you can justify it, and this is what I usually tell them, providing you can justify it in a well-argued way, you should be okay, particularly in your CPAC write-ups.
I'm really interested in that. Have you never been taught be pessimistic?
Yes, yes, to a point. I take that, but I think if you constantly expand your uncertainties every time, and are pessimistic, you end up with a slightly unscientific, because you're trying to make measurements of this. This is the point. You're trying to make measurements of uncertainty, and if every time you're rounding up and, you know, pushing the envelope out and being pessimistic, you end up with an unrealistically inflated uncertainty percentage at the end of it. To me, that would be my
would
instinct.
would you if you had three uncertainties, would you round up the uncertainty at the end of combining the percentages? I mean, that's another thing I would teach them, is you add up the percentages and then you work out the absolute uncertainty and then round that up to the precision of the answer. What about you, Dave?
I was just thinking about that. I would always keep the extra, you know, detail in the percentage and then only round it at the end. I would treat it like any other calculation like that. But then I'm fairly certain some people might do it differently. They would only ever have it to one significant figure, and then they would add those. So if they had a 9.8% error and a 5.6% error, they'd end up with a total combined uncertainty of 16%. Because they'd do 10 plus 6. But it's what I come back to is, like, say, because it is just an estimate, you know, as long as you're being sensible about it and you're not either completely saying, well, it's, you know, I've measured gravity to be 9.8 plus or minus 10, when that's not what your experiment shows, or you're overclaiming and sort of saying, oh, yeah, I've measured it to 11 decimal places, you're probably okay.
As long as you have a method. You have a method, and I think, but I like that be pessimistic, because you must have had, the kids always think they are the best experimenters since sliced bread, and they come in with some ridiculous uncertainty of like 5% in a lab where, you know, watching them, it's nearer 15%. And I like that be pessimistic thing.
Yeah, yes. And again, I would say so. Yeah, up to a point, it just feels wrong for my core to round 6.3 to 7.
It's not rounding 6.3 to 7. It's rounding the errors, the uncertainty. So it would be 6.3 plus or minus 0.7, which is a small change from 6.3 plus or minus 0.6, but it's just being pessimistic.
No, I was being sort of tongue-in-cheeky about my sort of like mathematical mind not being able to let go. But I certainly take your point. But again, I wouldn't want to do that unless I saw that explicitly stated somewhere in some sort of exam board guidance, because, you know, again, like I say, I'm looking at an OCR textbook where they have this value of resistance in their thing. You know, the final value they've come after combining errors to be 3.75 plus or minus 0.17 ohms. So OCR can't make mind up about it.
Yeah, I'm always a bit phlegmatic about because the other thing is I've seen, you know, mark schemes in different years can contradict themselves and things like that. So I'm always a bit worried about that. So I'm I think it is probably, you know, a little bit of laziness on my part. I tend to sort of teach the one that I think will make the most sense to them and have the most resonance with them. So maybe also one of the things I'd say is I always try and teach them a bit of a hierarchy of uncertainty. And I say the worst possible thing you can do is to say that your measurement, because you find it either difficult or you don't want to, or you can't understand how to, work out the uncertainty in a measurement, you just say there is no uncertainty. That's the worst possible sin at A level. There's no such thing as a measurement with no uncertainty. That's part one. Secondly, if you honestly are completely, like, if you come out of the lab and you say, oh, damn, I took that measurement and I didn't even consider uncertainty, you estimate it and you make a reasonable estimate that you justify in your report. So you say, I measured the length of the wire in the Young's modulus experiment and I made it 1 meter, but obviously a meter rule can only measure to this resolution and probably... it was very difficult to measure because it was quite far away from the ruler. So I'm estimating an uncertainty of plus or minus 1 centimetre in my measurement there. I said, that's next up. That's slightly better than say there's no uncertainty, but it's not particularly good. Resolution of your measuring instrument, obviously, is the minimum uncertainty that you can then quote. And then the gold standard in terms of uncertainty is that you've made an attempt to actually measure it. So in other words, you've taken a series of readings and you've looked at what errors you've got. And you looked at the range of, when I say errors, the range of uncertainties that you've got and the range of different measurements you've got, and you work out half of your range from there. So I kind of give them this hierarchy of uncertainty right the way through from the very, very bad, i.e. none, through to the gold standard, which is you're actually measuring it. You're putting some evidence behind your uncertainties. I don't know, is that something that you guys...
Yeah, see I've not thought about it in terms of a hierarchy. I actually quite like that idea, although I'd be tempted to switch around the two in the middle. Because I think sometimes the students, they will do a measurement where, you know, they've like the extension of a spring or something like that, where they've clamped a ruler up next to it and they're sort of just roughly eyeballing it from a meter away or as close as they dare to get to this terrifying spring that's going to snap and take out their eyeball, as we always tell them, is definitely going to happen. And then they look at the ruler and say, oh yeah, I was accurate to within half a millimeter because that's the resolution of the ruler. And I'm like, were you really?
Yes.
And you're actually thinking about that. And I think that's what I would, you know, again, thinking back to my days in the lab, you know, the important thing about errors is that you are really thinking carefully about where is your experiment going wrong or likely to go wrong. Where, and if you're just going to, you know, I would say the resolution of your ruler is only a starting point. You have to genuinely be, you know, happy yourself that you could actually measure to accurate to a millimeter. And, you know, the way to do it might be to, yeah, then take your measurement. And what that should do is guide them to, yeah, the top level of the hierarchy, which is do repeats and see, measure that uncertainty. So I would probably feel, I like the idea of the hierarchy, but I would actually have the resolution lower down the hierarchy than having a sensible think about the experiment, you know. Actually.
That makes sense to me. I'm changing my notes here. Switch with a little arrow. Let me go.
The one downside of that is you will have to ask the students to apply their brains, and they are notoriously unwilling to do that.
I agree with you absolutely about them using their brains on this, but that's why I think it's a fabulous topic to have in the A level, because I tend to notice, I don't know if you see the same pattern, but I get practical write-ups through the year, and when they start off and I've given them the uncertainty lecture, there's no such thing as a measurement without uncertainty. You know, sort of you will burn in the fires of eternal damnation if every measurement does not have an uncertainty associated with it, and all these sorts of things. And then, so you get in this sort of half-hearted write-up that talks about a little bit about uncertainty. It might have a column in the results table that has some uncertainties in it, but it fizzles out pretty quickly, and it certainly doesn't make it into the analysis phase, let alone the graph. And in terms of the evaluation, forget it. So you kind of, and then you chip away and you nag them and eventually my AS students now are just about getting to this stage where it's sort of starting to pervade all the way through, and I'm getting to the stage now where I'm saying, yes, but your conclusion now has to be, I measured this value to be X plus or minus Y, and then your evaluation is, and in terms of the book value, how does that compare to my uncertainties? Is it with my band of confidence? And if it's not, what do you think you got wrong? Which uncertainties do you not think you measured right? And we're just about getting to that after a year.
and I'd say that you're probably a bit ahead of me there. And certainly that would be my gold standard, is they have an evaluation where they've got a percentage error or an absolute error. And they state the true value is in my uncertainty or the true value isn't, and then go and talk about why there is that uncertainty. God, there's so much I want to ask you. So normally we have a lot of uncertainty in one direction. So, you know, the uncertainty in time might be 0.01% and the uncertainty in length might be 5%. But what if you've got horizontal and vertical error bars of the vertical ones are, say, a centimetre either side of the point, and the horizontal ones are, say, 5 mm either side of the point. When you do the line of best fit, do you allow them to draw an invisible box around that in their mind and hit the corner of the box, or do they have to hit the top of the error bar?
Yeah, at this point I would talk to them about how curve fitting by eye is something of an imprecise science. And that really, you know, they are eyeballing it, and yeah, they can sort of imagine a box around there. Again, I'm looking at the example in the OCR textbook, and that would appear to me to suggest that they are just using the vertical error bars.
Exactly, and I've seen that before, and I don't like it.
No, that it doesn't. Me. I see that. Yeah, that does look a bit extreme to me now.
They have to be able to, surely, if we understand error bars, they have to be able to clip the corner.
Yeah,
of the imaginary box.
So actually, I think probably your draw an imaginary box around it, I think would.
We need to write the book.
Mm.
Cool, right behind you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll proofread it. You.
That's great. Would all the volunteers take one step forward?
Yeah.
We could talk about uncertainties for a long time, and I'm sure our beloved listener would have some topics they'd like to talk to us about. So do share with us, contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
Yeah, tweet us @physicstp.
Or contact us through Instagram, physics_teaching_podcast. Now, before we go, Dr. Dave, you wanted to do a shout-out to Peter Edmonds, didn't you?
Yes. So I imagine a lot of listeners to the podcast, certainly UK ones who are on Twitter, might well have already come across Peter's resources before. So Peter runs a little website. He's a teacher, a physicist, head of physics, but he also has his little sort of blog site, which is sciencedoctor.school.blog. And on there, he tweeted out today when we're recording the podcast, done, finito, 9 GCSE booklets, 13 A-level booklets, 220 freely downloadable physics resources. So there is literally thousands of pounds worth of Peter's time has gone into these resources, and they're all completely free, and they're all, you know, very good. Like I happily take them and steal them all the time and plug them straight into a lesson, you know, confident that they will be well thought through and resourced. It really is a pretty amazingly generous resource Peter's created for everyone. So if you haven't seen them, go on there. You will undoubtedly save. I mean, as I understand it, when he was training, he thought, why isn't there a big bank of really good problem sets and resources that people can use? And instead of just grumbling about it and occasionally making some and keeping them on a hard drive somewhere like most teachers do, he's made them more freely available. So he deserves applause.
And he and we have something in common, and you bought us both a coffee.
Yes, absolutely. On his website, there's an option to buy me a coffee. So what I would encourage you to do is, if you've used some of his resources, imagine what you would have had to pay for them on any sort of site where you can buy resources, and perhaps think Peter could have made himself some money off them but didn't, and maybe he deserves a coffee. But yeah,
there's a lovely tweet I'm looking at this on the site now from friend of the podcast Bernard Rand.
Yeah.
Sharing your own teaching resources for free is an act against the marketization of education and the encroachment of capitalism and every aspect of our lives. #sharing is caring. Yeah, thank
comment.
You to everyone who's helped improve my teaching through what they've shared for free.
It's worth saying Bernard has shared some pretty amazing resources himself. I use some of his OCR ones. So.
Well, I think actually it's funny because I'm looking at a page now that says special thanks to Bernard Rand for allowing me to use many of his questions. So I think Peter had some help from Bernard as well. And I think it's absolutely true. And one thing I noticed actually is that Peter said he hasn't posted answers to the questions there. So that's perhaps one way you can help, is if you do some answers for these, perhaps send them through to Peter so that he can have the option of publishing them if he wants to or not. But it's fantastic. Resource.
I think there are some examples of that where people have done answers and sent them to him. I think there's also been some examples of people pestering him and saying, when are you putting the answers online, which is rather rude. but yes, so I think if you want answers, then if they're not on there, write them yourself and share them like he has.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much to future guest Peter Edmonds, sciencedoctor.school.blog.
Yes, absolutely. And a coffee on its way to you, Peter. Thanks ever so much.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your time, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks indeed, Thomas. I'll see you next week.
And thank you very much, Dr. Dave.
That's okay. I'm more than happy to. I've actually updated my Twitter bio after you mentioned me in the last one. So I'm now the Evel Knievel of physics teaching in my Twitter bio. So thank you for that, Robin. I quoted you.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, my legacy is assured.
Dr. Dave shared a video he's made for his kids on YouTube. For the first 5 minutes of the video, I was waiting for him to be hit by a TA coming off camera. And I will say, if you ever find a link to this video, it's worth watching till the very end. I won't tell you anything more.
I think that video will be hidden away for good.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks this week to Dr. Dave Farmer. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas WP, and Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.